I was known in prison as Happy Jimmy because I knew, and it was something that my mom had taught me as a boy, that one of the only things that we have control over is our attitude. That regardless of where I find myself, I have the choice whether I smile. I have the choice whether I'm happy. People cannot take my joy. They can take away my liberties. They can take away my freedoms. They can treat me like garbage, but they can't take away who I am.
Welcome to Backseat Driver, the podcast hosted by two practicing psychotherapists, where we boil down years of experience with clients young and old to teach you how to do the what to do to improve your life and relationships.
I'm Mark Yamada, clinical psychologist in Seattle.
And I'm Nikki Bennett, licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City. Something I read recently from Glennon Melton, who's one of my favorite authors and influencers out there, she was asked recently, when do you share your story with somebody? How long do you wait before you share all the rough stuff from your past? And what she said was, she said, I'm a big fan of telling the truth as quickly and often as possible so that we eliminate the wrong people efficiently. I loved that. She said, you know, we really don't need more than about five people to remember their birthdays and special events, and we might as well just weed the other ones out quickly. And that's one of the things that I've loved on our podcast, is just hearing people's raw stories. And Jimmy, I don't know a lot about your story, but I do know a little bit just from our interactions on social media, and then obviously from my friendship with your dear sister Rhonda, who passed away early July of pancreatic cancer. And again, my heart goes out to you and your family.
Thank you.
So Jimmy, I'd love to just start out by asking you to share your story with our listeners and with us.
Yeah, so my amazing sister and I were born and raised in San Diego, California. And then when my sister was a senior and I was in eighth grade, we moved up to Northern California, a small town called Paradise. And that's where I did my high school years. I'm not sure if you recall, maybe 2 years ago, Paradise, the entire town burned down. Thankfully, my family had already moved out of Paradise at that point. I recently have been back to Paradise for the first time since the fires. And
wow.
And it's interesting how you don't really feel an attachment if you don't go back to the place, if that makes sense. But when you walk on the dirt where you spent years of your life, where your family had a home, and there's nothing there except dirt, it's a really stark difference where you go, well, this can't be, because in my mind, I remember everything. I remember the front door. I remember our family room. I remember our kitchen where mom made so many amazing meals. I remember the view. And even the view out over Sawmill Peak and over the Feather River looked different without having that window there or that lens. And I think it's the same way in any aspect of your life. Things are how you remember them. If you don't allow for yourself to go back there, whether it's physically or mentally, you don't really have the ability to look through it, perhaps through a new lens. And I kind of liken that to a child who is playing baseball in the backyard with his dad. His dad tossed a ball and a kid just hit it as hard as he could, and it flew over the fence and broke his neighbor's window. You know, the child obviously feels bad. That wasn't the intent. He's just trying to hit the darn ball. He goes and he apologizes to the neighbor, and whether the neighbor chooses to forgive or not, you know, the child continues to grow up and perhaps leaves the town, goes to college, has a good profession, comes back to the town, and maybe the only memory that that neighbor or others who that neighbor may have talked to about the incident, the only thing they remember is that little boy broke a window. And I think that in people's minds, naturally they want to believe the good and the happy. But I think a lot of times they hold on to the negative or the hurt. In life, you have to give people the benefit of the doubt and listen to what's really going on, because it's super easy to just jump onto the negative train. What's going on in the world right now, tell me how easy it would be to just jump on that negative train.
You're reminding me, Jimmy, of a story of my husband who was, he is very yellow. I don't know if you've listened to our last episode on the color code, but just creative and fun and quite impulsive at times. And as a kid, he was kind of the rebel rouser in the neighborhood. They went penny tapping one time to scare the neighbors and broke a window. And he helped himself to the neighbor's chocolate cake when they were out of town. And he was a real stinker. And so going back to that community, when we would go to church with his dad, we were always greeted with I mean, honestly, everybody we saw was like, you're Ben? You're Ben? You actually are still around and you're a decent human being? Because like you said, their frame of reference was Ben as a little boy, not Ben as a grown, mature adult.
Oh, yeah. And people will even tell you, you know, when they greet you, oh, yeah, I remember when you blah, 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 you know, garden raided all of our tomatoes.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that if you fast forward that to, because it's easy to remember somebody as a child and then as an adult, but when an incident happens in life as an adult, and then you continue to move forward, some people only want to remember that incident. So I remember I moved to a new area, and I was enjoying life. I had gotten married, and I received a text message, and I remember distinctly, it was the morning after Mother's Day. And I received this text message, and the text message is, I know who you really are. And then it was just this blast of negativity. And I'm not really one to beat around the bush. If somebody has something to say to me, let's talk. You know, let's hear what's going on. And so I said, hey, let's meet up. Let's have a chat. And so we ended up meeting up that evening at a neutral place. And I said, okay, fire away. Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me what you're feeling. And they had gone and taken the time to read online all the negativity, which is out there about me. And after, you know, all that expression come out, I said, okay, well, you've known me for the last 6 months. Is that your experience with me? And he's like, well, no, but I can see why you're all into Jesus right now. And I just laughed and I shook my head. And I said, well, yeah, I didn't know, man. I've always been into Jesus. Like, this isn't a new thing. You know,
right.
The Savior's been part of my life forever. And even when we make mistakes, and especially when we make mistakes, the Savior's a part of your life. And we had conversation. He said, you know what, I violated a code that I made a long time ago, which is I need to take time to get both sides of the story before I make an assessment. But he was really angry. And the hard part is, through that conversation, I found out that he didn't just keep it to himself. Unfortunately, he reached out to mutual friends of ours in the community. And he reached out to them on Mother's Day. And, you know, these are people that live, I'm saying, within two blocks of me, you know. Wow. And so I go and I have conversations, forced to have conversations with these people and go through the same thing. And what's interesting is, for whatever reason, people want to believe the absolute worst in somebody and say, aha, I gotcha.
I think it's fear. Do you, Mark? Is it just that we're trying to protect ourselves from being hurt?
Yeah, it really is that. It's curious things with human nature that I think sometimes we're kind of wired to automatically gravitate to the negative as the more salient. And it just automatically happens that way. And it actually takes some intentional effort to look at things from another perspective, to see it in a better light. And I think that that's one of the messages, Jimmy, that I think people can get from you is, you know, let us look for other things in people other than just the things that were weaknesses or that maybe we made mistakes on, that I am more than that. Or if I was once that, that is not who I am today.
No, absolutely. And there has to be the ability of rebuilding. And on that note, I can touch on the prison aspect of things. When somebody gets sentenced, it's for a duration of time that society deems as necessary for somebody to make up for a mistake they made, right? We feel that because of the severity of what you've done, you should spend this amount of time. And ultimately, if we believe in justice through that course, and we believe that if time has been served, then we believe that that aspect in some way should be shelved, right? And I also feel that if somebody's going to look back at a time in my life, which was 12 years ago, and say, I know who you really are, I think, oh, gosh, I'm not sure if you know who I really am, or if you simply know a tiny glimpse of a chapter in my life.
It's so shame-driven, right? It's like, we're not our behaviors. And when we think we are, that's where shame originates. And so he's thereby saying, oh, because this thing happened, now I know who you are.
Right.
Which is so toxic. So tell us more about your life, Jimmy, after living in paradise, which from what I heard from your sister and from Chris, really was like paradise on earth. And now having that gone, tell us more about your life and what got you to where you are today.
So obviously there's a whole bunch because, yeah, I jumped from 96 to 2017 and then back. So there's a whole bunch of gaps, but from paradise, I went to college out in Utah, loved it. And my mother, a couple of years after my mom passed away, suddenly she had a stroke. And my mom was the mortar in our family. She held everything together in our family. If I talked to my mom every single day in my life, and my sister did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And my parents moved from paradise out to Utah when I came home from my mission to be close to my sister and I, because they said, well, shucks, if our two children are out in Utah, why on earth would we stay in California? So we just have a really tight family unit where I can honestly say my best friends in life are my sister, my mom, and my dad. And I just really enjoy spending time with my family. When we get together for Christmas, we would stay up for hours and hours and hours just talking. And we just really enjoy spending time together. And so losing my mom was, but when you have that experience of losing a parent suddenly, where you really don't get the opportunity to say goodbye, you didn't have any preparation for it, you really start to pray and have actual real prayers, not please bless this food that'll taste good and nourish and strengthen my bodies. I mean, how often did we pray on cookies and brownies to nourish and strengthen our bodies at church
and do us the good that we need?
that's
scripted.
Exactly. So losing my mom was a big hardship for my sister and I, and I moved back home with dad, and we just helped put the pieces together as best we could during a time of pain and of loss. And so that really continued to strengthen our family. We just been a really strong family. So fast forward a few years, I decided to start a company, an investing company. And with that investing company, I brought in money from investors. If I would give them a return for the ability to utilize their money to extend loans, things of that variety. Unfortunately, business isn't always cut and dry. And I made some poor business decisions. The economy, but the time frame was 2008. I had my company between 2006 and 2009. Anybody who lived through the economy of 2008 knows what happened to the housing market and everything. I mean, it's the first time that the banking system melted down, and I was directly affected by that. And unfortunately, I lost all of my money and all of my investors' money. And understandably, my investors were upset. And if I were in their shoes, I would be equally as upset. Nobody likes to lose money. And through time, a couple of years later, I was indicted on what happened during that time with my company. And through the court process, because I was federally indicted, I received a 48-month prison sentence, served my time. And afterwards, I had 3 years of probation. I was known in prison as Happy Jimmy, because I knew, and it was something that my mom had taught me as a boy, that one of the only things that we have control over is our attitude. That regardless of where I find myself, I have the choice whether I smile. I have the choice whether I'm happy. People cannot take my joy. They can take away my liberties. They can take away my freedoms. They can treat me like garbage, but they can't take away who I am. That was important to me. And I can go into the prison experience, but suffice it to say, people ultimately in prison are the same as people are out here in the real world. They care about their family. They want their family to be okay. They miss their loved ones, and they worry about, you know, being able to get out and take care of their family. Really, ultimately, people inside a prison are just like people outside. And I think that until I went in, I didn't fully understand. I remember anytime I would drive by a prison, I'd think, my goodness, I would never want to live close to this, because what if a bad guy got out? He'd probably kill me. You know, I think about, like, in Utah, for instance, you drive by the point of the mountain, you always see that prison and the orange lights in the evening. You're like, oh, I would never live anywhere near here. And yet, you know, when you're inside there, of course, bad things happen in there. But for the most part, people are good. They unfortunately made mistakes. One thing that's interesting to me is it's almost as though the system and society doesn't want you to forget what you've done. And with that, because I'm a convicted felon, it was a white collar crime. Every single time I do any kind of a important document in my life, I have to check the box. I am a convicted felon. If I'm getting a job, I have to bring it up and let them know the nature of my crime and stuff. And the hard part about that to me is, at what point am I allowed to move forward with my life?
You said it's been 12 years, Jimmy?
I had my business between 2006 and 2008, 2009. I think I finished things up around 2009. So it's been 11 years. Wow. And from the beginning, it's been 14 years, right?
So is this something that's going to be on your record forever?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it will be. And there's a lot of limitations just for the fact that, you know, I'm a convicted felon. And I still have my restitution amount. You know, I served my time. I still have to pay off the money, which I agree with. I believe that the people who lost money absolutely 100% deserve to receive their money back. They absolutely do. And I'm working diligently so that they have the ability to get paid back. When you think about some of the restrictions, though, there's some industries I'm not allowed to be in. And some of those industries, you know, have the ability to pay you back pretty well. For instance, if I decide to sell insurance, insurance salesmen make a great living. If you look at some of the wealthiest people in the world over the course of the last 100 years that have built their fortunes, insurance sales is one of them. And finding how many brick walls are up there, which would prevent me from being able to sell insurance, it's massive. And it's the same thing with real estate. You look at the commission structures and how much money realtors have the ability to make if they're hardworking. And so there's a couple industries that I would love to be part of, which right now in my life, I simply can't because of the laws that are structured. My understanding is I can't become a doctor and I can't become a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so some of these professions are totally, you know, just chopped off because of a decision that was made prior to my life. And so you have to think, well, what kind of a job can I get? And there's a lot of companies I found, interestingly, that just won't hire me. And so you think, well, how am I supposed to not only provide for myself and my spouse and my future family, but how am I supposed to earn enough to take care of our needs and to pay this back when so many industries are shut off, you know, to people like me?
So how much do you have to pay back? I'm curious.
It's just under $3 million is what I, is what.
Wow. Wow. So, and then what happens if you don't pay it back? Do you go back to jail?
No. Good. First off, I will pay it back. But secondly, it's just a matter of time. And so every single month I make a restitution payment to pay things back.
Gosh, it feels, I'm struggling. It feels like the unpardonable sin. There's a fascinating TED Talk by Johan Hari on addiction. And he talks about how the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. And what do we do to people when they mess up? We put them in solitary confinement. We put them in prison. We take away their connection. And so that was done to you. But then also it's like you're carrying this, what do you even want to call it? You're carrying this label around as an ex-convict for the rest of your life. How do you deal with something like that? It's really tough. I'm feeling actually resentment for you, but you seem to not be feeling that. So tell our listeners, how do you deal with something like that?
So ultimately what I found, and it comes from, I was picked up back east, and I was transported through the system to get back to Utah, where my charges were out of. And for a period of time, I was in a federal prison in Brooklyn. Just so you know, you don't want to go to federal prison in Brooklyn. It is a really rough place. It's really
and you rough grew place. Up. You grew up pretty well, right? Dad was a dentist, and grew up pretty comfortably, I think.
Yeah, grew up in a normal, happy home, playing sports and having fun. And truly, people that know me, I'm the last person that anybody would ever think that would go to prison. Like, it's just not in my DNA, right? But when you make mistakes, you have to face the consequences of the mistakes you make, and I did. So when I was in Brooklyn, there was a gentleman that I met, and another inmate, and it was interesting how he referred to himself. He said, you know, I've been an ex-con for 24 years, and I just got hemmed up with this new case, and you know, I need to serve my time. And I thought to myself, and I hadn't at this point been sentenced or convicted. I had, you know, just been picked up on indictment. And I thought to myself, my goodness, at what time in your life do you quit referencing yourself as an ex-con?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been, for this guy, you know, he was in his 60s at the time. And he's like, yeah, I've been an ex-con for over 20 years. And I just thought, well, when do you stop identifying as that? Like, when do you stop? When does that go away? When do you move forward with your life? And for not just, I guess, forgive yourself. And I think that that's really what it's about in my mind's eye is forgiving yourself. And so I don't think that he was ever able to fully forgive himself. And he found himself in a similar situation later in life, and he was back. And what's interesting, as far as you ask me, how do you stay positive? Daily, I'm reminded of what has happened in my life. Daily, there's not a moment that goes by, truly, and definitely not a day that goes by. Probably not even a couple of hours that I don't think about the investors who trusted me and took time to invest and believed in me in order for things to go well. I worry for them. I hurt because I'm not able for them to have their money back right now. I feel guilt still. And through one thing is, you know, I was told I'm not to have any contact with them. I've been told, you know, by my attorney, you're not to have any contact with the people that, you know, are seen as victims in the case. And the hard part about that, anybody who's gone through a 12-step program knows that one of the things is, you know, trying to make restitution, apologizing and trying to make a restitution to the people. And what's difficult is I really don't even have the opportunity to talk to these individuals and say, I am so sorry. I am in my heart so sorry for the pain and the stress that has gone on in your life because of my decisions. I'm so sorry for that. And I think that's one of the hardest parts. But you also can't dwell on that portion of life. And so it's a daily choice to smile. It's a daily choice to laugh. It's a daily choice to look for the good, especially right now in the world when there's so many people that are focusing and pointing their finger at the bad.
It's really an acquired skill to be able to intentionally, you know, make this decision that I'm going to look forward. I'm going to look up. Even when there are so many things around you, or even others who would want to make sure that you could never forgive or forget. That makes it really, really hard, because how much of the time do you feel in this domain that you are so alone?
I definitely feel that it's hard for people to fully understand how I feel or what I'm going through because, I mean, Nikki, you haven't gone to prison, you know? My family hasn't gone to prison. My wife hasn't gone to prison, thankfully, right? I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Exactly.
Prison's not fun. The food is horrible, regardless of what the news is trying to tell you. The food is not good there at all. So, it's your question, how often do you feel alone? I guess I can honestly say I've never felt alone. And the reason for that is God's always there. If you want to see the atonement of Jesus Christ in action, go to a prison. In times we're either compelled to be humble or we choose to be humble. People in prison are compelled to be humble at that time in their life. Not to say that I hadn't gone. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting because like you said, you drive by the point of the mountain. It's like, oh, the prison. What if somebody escapes or it gets me? But everybody I know, whether it be from graduate school or at church, people that work at the prison talk about what a magical place it is. Help us understand more what that experience was like and what the people there are like. Sure, there are the bad ones, but I would bet by and large, most of them are just really good people who have made some poor decisions. So help us understand what it's like there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had some cellmates that were, you know, that lived in my cell with me, because there's usually one or two inmates in the cell.
And are you literally like behind bars with just a toilet in there and nothing else? Or what's it like? All I've seen is TV shows.
So before I got sentenced, I was in a county jail. And I was in a county jail for a year and a half before I got sentenced. Maybe 2 years before I was sentenced. And in a county jail, yeah, you're literally in a cell with a bunk bed and a toilet with a sink on top of it. And the toilet, if you're in the bottom bunk, is like 8 inches from your face.
Oh my gosh.
And so if your cellie needs to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, like, dude's flushing the toilet right there, you know? And really, it's a humiliating experience. They have a slot in the door. Everybody's, you know, locked up, and then you get your food tray. And then depending on what's going on in the jail at the time, sometimes we're locked down for days or weeks at a time where you don't get out of your cell. And your cell's maybe 10 feet by 8 feet, and you got a bunk bed in there, and you have a toilet and a sink and maybe a metal desk and a little chair to sit on, and that's it.
Do you get blankets? Do you have pens? Or, you know, yeah. My mind, they're taking away your blankets and your sheets and the pens and anything you could hurt yourself or someone else with.
It does depend on what's going on, but usually you have a set of sheets and a blanket, and you have two jumpsuits that you're using.
But no privacy whatsoever, obviously.
No, huh? Nope. And then you usually, I'd say, at least in that county jail, you probably had maybe 36 cells in a quad. And you had one TV about 40 feet up on the wall. And yeah, the channel is whatever the person in charge chooses, and as loud as it is, it's a different experience being fed through a hole with a little slot in the door.
Were you scared? I would have been afraid to be beat up, or I just can't even imagine the terror you would feel.
No, I wasn't scared. And I guess that's, I've always been able to make friends easily, and people can tell if you're genuinely a good person or not. And so I wasn't ever scared.
What was the most challenging thing about those years?
Not being able to be with my family, not being able to see my nieces and my nephews grow, not being able to support their athletic events or their school events, just being away from them. I think that would be truly the hardest part of prison, is being completely separated from your family. They limit how much you can make phone calls, and they charge you an astronomical amount of money to make phone calls.
Really? I had no idea.
Yeah, no, it's not like, oh, sweet, just you got a cell phone plan and you make as many calls as you want. No, the system makes so much money on phone calls to family. And I think that that is completely wrong, especially with the statement that you made that somebody needs that connection with family and they don't have that ability. And if you don't have the money to make the phone calls, like you just don't have any communication. You can write letters. But you have to pay for postage. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of difficulty in keeping communication up.
So how did you deal with those dark days? Because I'm sure you had them. What were those days like and what got you through it?
I worked out a lot. I'm not sure if you know what burpees are. Burpees are something that kind of became my lifeline. I would do 1200 straight burpees in my cell. I just do burpees. I do 50 every 5 minutes and just rip straight through it. And I did 1200 burpees in a row every day. And for me, it's because exercise has always been an outlet for me, whether it's swimming or riding a bike or running. And when you are working out, your mind is just in a different place because you're focusing so much on pushing away the pain of your physical exercise that you just, runners call it being in the zone or runner's high. And it's the same type of a thing, no matter what you're doing. Well, obviously I didn't have access to anything like that. So I just did burpees and days where life felt heavy. I wouldn't say there were dark days or bad days, but sometimes life just feels a little heavy. It's pressing. On those days, I would just work out even harder. And that allowed me to sweat out and to get my mind to focus on something other than that.
Is that something you were born with or taught? Because I'm thinking, here I am on lockdown and quarantine for 14 days with my family in Hawaii. And some of my days have felt dark and hopeless and frustrating. And that's 2 weeks. Is that something that you were just born with or something you learned to have that optimistic, bright attitude? I mean, that's like fascinating that you didn't experience that to me.
So I didn't get married until I was in my 40s. And I did a lot of dating and anytime, which means I've had a lot of broken hearts. Right. And so anytime I'd get my heart broken, I put on I just call it my angry music. It would just be, you know, upbeat music in my headphones. I get on my bicycle and I just go race cars downtown. I would just go race cars and just thrash myself to pure exhaustion. Because I was able to have control over my workout, right? I may not be able to control if somebody else decides they love me or don't love me, but I do have control over how hard I exert energy onto the pedals. And so typically, yeah, when I would have heartbreak or different heaviness times where you just feel like, my gosh, now what? I would work out hard. And so it's just been a kind of a part of me. And so I just continued to do that. But I also don't have a problem being alone. Now, one part of my life that I didn't talk about was when I rode my pedal bicycle through the United States for a couple of years. I rode my bike through the US for a couple of years and I would just stop and camp on the side of the road in my tent. And I would pick up odd and end jobs as I went. And that was before I went to prison. And that time really solidified my relationship with my Savior because it was just him and I out there. You know, I wouldn't talk to my family for months and months and months on end. And I might drop them a line once in a while, just to let them know I was alive and doing well. But I rode all over the Continental 48 and absolutely loved every second of it. It was sensational. I'd run into a farmer that needed help with a fence or needed help with the harvest or whatever. And I'd work hard for a couple of days and earn money and just push on. And it was,
so Jimmy,
yeah,
tell us more what that's about. I think the question that comes up for me is, were you hiding? Were you afraid you were going to get caught? Or was it just a time in your life that you were just seeking solace and more learning and growth?
So was I hiding? No. How it all came about was I had an aunt that had passed away of cancer up in Oregon, and I went up to her funeral. And prior to that, I was trying to figure out how to pay off my debts. And I had started a company, and I was working 6 days a week all day, trying to build up a business so that I can pay off all my debts, so I could pay off my investors and move on with life. I was trying to think of a way to pay everybody back. So I hadn't taken a break in months. And I drove up to Oregon to the funeral, and I got in at maybe 5:30 in the morning, and my dad was out there and my stepmom, and I crashed on their hotel room floor for maybe 2 hours before we got up and went over to the funeral. And afterwards, I was going to get in my car and drive straight back down to Southern California and keep working on my business. As I was getting in my car, I looked at my dad. I was like, "Dad, can we just hang out for a little while?" My dad's like, "Well, yeah, I haven't seen you in 8 months. Yeah, I'd love to. We're heading over to Tahoe. You know, why don't you follow us?" So I followed my dad through, and we stopped at a little town called Grass Valley on our way up to Tahoe. And we got some lunch, and Dad and I were sharing a banana split walking down their main street. And I saw a bicycle in a storefront window. And I was like, "That is the most beautiful bike I've seen in my entire life." And it was a bike that the frame was completely made out of bamboo. Wow. And I said, "Dad, one day when all this stuff is figured out, I'm going to buy that bike and I'm going to ride it around the world." My dad took a bite of the banana split and he looked at me and said, "Well, if anybody can do it, my little boy can." And so we got up to Tahoe and we got some food at a bistro there. And I just sat down next to my dad, or across from my dad at the table. And I hadn't said a word. And my dad just looks at me and he says, "You're going, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "When?" I said, "Apparently right now." He said, "Well, how are you?" He's like, "Well, how are you going to do this?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know." I said, "But I feel like I want to pay off my debts." And man, I got to think outside the box. And right then a girl came up to pour water at our table. And I turned to her and I said, "Hi, I'm going to ride my bike through the country. Cause I'm trying to pay off my debts. I got myself in a lot of debt. Would you be willing to help me on my journey?" And she pulled a dollar out of her apron and set it on the table and she said, "Good luck." I said, "Thank you." And that was that. I slept in Tahoe that night. I drove back down to Southern California the next day, and 2 weeks later I was on my bicycle and I was riding through the country. And at that time I named myself a debt-free cyclist because I was trying to get out of debt. And that's ultimately what I was doing. My goal was, I want to ride through the country and I want to talk about it. I want to write a book about it. And the proceeds that I'm going to make from this, I'm going to use to pay off my debts. So any money that came to me to help with the paying off of my debts, I kept in one place. And the money that I used to live on, meaning I would get jobs and utilize that money to eat with, I always kept, you know, those monies separate. And that was my goal. And after I'd been on the road for a couple of months, you know, I really like listening to John Maxwell and Proctor and some of these other amazing motivational speakers. And I think maybe it was even in The Secret, the movie in the book, The Secret. But the reference was, if you're thinking about debt, I don't think if you're thinking get into it or get out of it, if you're focused on debt, you're going to attract debt. So I thought, well, I'm trying to be the debt-free, but maybe the fact that I have debt in there, I'm just going to continue to accumulate this negativity. And so at that point, I got rid of my username as Debt-Free Cyclist, and I transitioned over to something that was unique about what I was doing, which was I was riding a bicycle made out of bamboo. And so when I was on the road, it was in order to think of a creative way to raise money to pay off my debts. Because think of it in this way. I owe $3 million. If I made 3 million friends and I asked them to please help me by giving me a dollar, I could pay off my restitution tomorrow, couldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Now people would say, well, you shouldn't be borrowing money for that. It's like, okay, I hear that. You need to go out and you need to earn money. Okay, tell me the best way to go earn $3 million.
And also live day to day.
Right. Right. And so that's how I was hoping to do it. I was like, you know, when I ride through the country, maybe I can get on Oprah. Maybe I can talk to Dave Letterman. Maybe I can, you know, have some interviews and it'll raise awareness of what I'm doing. Write a book. The proceeds of my book can all go to pay this off. You know, that's in my mind what was going on. And that all came to a screeching halt. Now, before I say the screeching halt, I did have a couple threats on my life before I left Utah. I had a couple people that wanted me dead because I owed them money. Mm-hmm. And I was not really wanting to die. And I really didn't receive very much money for people trying to help and paying things off. I had one incredibly generous follower she was out of Canada that donated. I say very generous because I'm used to getting like 50 cents or a quarter or a dollar. Mm-hmm. But she was very kind and I said, I was generous. Why did you, please, you don't have to do that. And she said, well, this is what this is about, right? You're trying to pay off your debts. You're trying to move on with your life. And when I received that donation, I think it was $200 or $150, something like that. That's when I stopped with getting donations. Because I just thought, you know what, it's one thing to ask 3 million people to give me a buck, but it's another thing for somebody to, you know, to give me like 150 or 200, like that's just too much. I don't want to put anybody out. And so I just stopped receiving monies from people at that point. I didn't want for people to have to do that. And I thought, you know, I'll just write my book once I finish riding through the country. And
bring us back to when you got out of jail. What was that day like when you first hugged your family for the first time? What was that like?
When I left that facility, I got picked up by my dad, my stepmom, and at that time, my girlfriend. She's now my wife. And I was on a furlough. I had the ability to drive in their car with them back to Utah, where I had to check into the halfway house. And that car ride was awesome, where we could just talk. I mean, you're on a pretty tight time schedule, so we only had time to stop and get a quick bite to eat and then get back on the road and bring me in. I had to check in that night at the halfway house. But that time where I was able to hug and to have just normal conversation, it was a very happy moment. It was great. Even though I still had to do time in the halfway house and supervised release and stuff, at least I had the ability to hold my girlfriend's hand and give my dad a hug. And
your girlfriend, did you date her before you went to prison? And how did you stay in contact that whole time? That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, so we ended up dating for 7 years before we got married. And yeah, I met her before I went into prison. And we just, when you know somebody's awesome, you know somebody's awesome. And there's plenty of people that try to tell her that I wasn't, but thankfully she stuck by her feelings, and we were married in the temple, in the Kona Hawaii temple, and have had an amazing marriage, just like we had an amazing courtship. So when I was in prison, I refer to those times like the letter writing years mm-hmm. of our relationship. And part of it kind of reminds me of like World War II, for instance, where you have servicemen that are out doing everything that they can, and their wives or girlfriends at home, and those letters would mean a lot, right? You read multiple stories where they'd have a picture of their sweetheart or whatever in their helmet. And in prison, it was a lot like that, where I'd write letters and she would write letters back. Interesting though, every single letter when I was in county was copied and sent to the prosecution. So
on both ends, so her letters and yours.
Yeah. So you have no privacy. If you think you have privacy, you're just stupid. You just don't understand the judicial system. And so anything that I would write, and you know, I'm cheap. You have to buy your paper and your pencils. And so I'm doing everything I can to conserve space. And so I'm writing really small. And I remember that prison guard said, Donahue, you need to start writing bigger. It's, you know, we're having a really tough time reading what you're writing. And I just laugh. It's like, you're kidding me, right? Like, you gotta be kidding me. Anyway, so yeah, that was our letter writing years. And actually after I got out, we took all of our letters and went to a fire pit and just burned them. Like, that chapter in our life is done. And it was liberating.
So Jimmy, that chapter is so done. And yet with the website up and, you know, the smear campaign continues to go on, how do you keep from being bitter?
I guess I try to put myself in their shoes. If I had trusted somebody and I had put money with them in good faith and it was gone and I didn't have the ability to communicate with them, I would be really hurt and I'd be really upset. So I think one of the ways that I keep from being bitter, and of course, you know, I still have my moments of frustration once in a while, but one way I keep from being bitter is like, you know what, if I was in their shoes, man, I probably would act in the same or very similar way. I'd probably feel very similar to them. And I realized that these people, especially when we were doing business together, these people were my friends. And I think it hurts more that I can't, you know, just go visit with them or go get a bite to eat or laugh because of what happened with business. It's totally scarred any hope of a friendship moving forward. Right. And so I think that's one of the hard aspects. But being bitter, it's like trying to, when you poison somebody else, you're poisoning yourself, and it's just not worth it.
How do you deal with people you love, like your good friends, coming across this information? In other words, when do you tell your rough stories? Going back to that Glennon quote, I think her words really resonate with me. I'm kind of the type that's like, here I am, love me or leave me. There's a quote in her book where she says, I'd rather you hate me for who I am, then love me for who I'm not. Something along those lines. How do you deal with that? How do you share your story? When do you share your story? Or how do you deal with it when it comes up like that?
I guess my real question would be, at what point do I have to stop telling my story? But I guess I never really can.
Mm-hmm. Someone else is telling it for you, but inaccurately.
Or at least their version of it, or through their lens. It's kind of like if you ever have a friend that's been divorced, when you listen to their side of it and listen to their spouse's side of it, it's two different angles. And so you're right. The only voice that has been out there has been their voice, and I haven't put out my voice yet. And I've asked myself that same question. When am I going to talk about what happened? And I've had intention to do it. I just haven't done it yet. And so I guess I need to do it now so that people have the ability to listen to both sides and then make their assertion.
Yeah. It reminds me of when I went through my divorce years ago. My approach was, I'm not going to tell anybody anything about this because, number one, it's not their business. And number two, I loved and cared about my spouse. Even though I was choosing to end a marriage that no longer worked for me, I was not interested in a smear campaign. And then suddenly I began hearing from people that I loved these falsehoods, these inaccurate depictions of what happened. And at that point, I had to make a decision. Am I going to speak my truth, or am I going to sit by and, you know what I mean? It's been really hard. And I've gone through different phases of my life where I talked about it all the time. I didn't talk about it at all because I didn't want it to define me. And now it just feels like, honestly, a blip in my past that is my story. And I think for me now, I've come to a point where I'm like, you know, this is my story. It happens to be someone else's too, but this is my story and how it impacted me.
And I think that that's critical, because in times where I have spoken out publicly about what has happened to me, inevitably there's a couple people that come up to me from the congregation or the audience afterwards that says, I had no idea that you've gone through that. I never would have guessed that you went through that, but I need to talk to you about what I'm going through, or what I have gone through, or what's currently going on in my life. And I realized that there's a lot of people who need help right now. And also, I think that felons need a better voice. I think that felons people need to realize that, hey, you know what? They're not all bad guys. And maybe the laws are a little more ridiculous on some of these cases than perhaps they should be.
Yeah, I think the day that I read your post, was it a video, Jimmy, where you were talking about this whole experience, or was it a post? Do you remember?
Yeah.
A couple of years ago?
I don't remember. It must not have been a very good one. So I don't recall.
You know
it, so.
What it was? It was, because I'll never forget the way that it impacted me when I listened to it. I was so touched by your courage and your authenticity. And my respect for you just went up exponentially. I don't know that I even had realized you had gone to jail when I read that. I heard that, or whatever it was. But I remember just feeling a connection with you. Not that I've ever gone to jail, but the pain in you and the pain in me, they're the same. They're different, but they're the same.
Yeah, it's the personal aspect of the story that other people can relate to and be helped by it. I think a lot of times when we've made errors or have great weakness or feel like we failed at something, we naturally tend to get shameful or embarrassed about it and try to hide it. And that even is more so when, understandably, other people are upset or kind of want to hunt you down. You don't want to, you know, be further beat up. But there is this aspect of clarifying things, and that can be helpful to other people as well, where you were talking about that sometimes other people will get their ideas about you, or they'll just believe everything somebody else says and don't do their own diligence to really find out what the truth really is before making their own opinion. And because of that, I think when you share your story in as authentic a way as you can, then it can clarify some things for other people, but it can also help both, you know, yourself sharing your story, but the listener hearing it may also be helped to move through something very difficult.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that somebody being able to identify with a portion of it, if it only helps somebody to be reflective of something that's going on in their life and see if there's a way through it. There's a couple people who are facing prison time that I've been asked to visit with. And as I've sat down to visit with them, you know, they're like, well, what's it going to be like? And I said, just remember the importance of being kind, because if you're kind, it's going to be easier. Not to say that there weren't moments where I had to not be kind in there, because, you know, sometimes people aren't always nice. We'll just say that. And so there's times where you have to stand up for yourself, and sometimes, you know, enough's enough. And
I think that's pretty incredible. And, you know, most people I find as I share my stories, I shared in episode 2, I believe, my story of anxiety and OCD, and that was a scary thing to do. Most people respond really well because it's the humanness that we all share. Even though our stories are different, again, they're the same. There are some people, though, that it makes very uncomfortable. And my opinion is that the people it makes uncomfortable, they're just too afraid to share their own story. One of our listeners said to me that her mother listened to our episodes, Mark, where we shared our stories, and said, I don't understand why you have to share your stories. Why can't you just let sleeping dogs lie? And this particular listener is going through trying to reconcile her painful history and tell her story and heal through that process. That's what I mean by some people, I think, don't want to hear our stories because it reminds them that they have a story too, and they're afraid maybe to share it.
That's a tough one. That is really tough because it's often a little bit messy. You know, Jimmy was commenting about that, you know, about that, you know, your own story does affect and does include other people. My thought on that is, you know, certainly understanding other people's desires and needs for privacy. But the world is changing. And one of the things, we are in a constant developmental process, you know, individually, culturally, you know, as a country, you know, as a world, we're going through a lot of changes, and we've got to be able to adapt and adjust and evolve. And one of the things that has kept us from doing that is, you know, tradition has a certain way of keeping our thinking very, very, you know, unchanged. And when it's a good thing, then it really is helpful. But one of the tough things about tradition is the resistance to change, especially if it's something that, you know, is a bad thing or doesn't really have as much applicability or usefulness now. So, you know, for, you know, listener's mother who is concerned about, you know, why dig up the past, you know, I look at it as we're not really... The goal is certainly not to dig up the past. And that, I think, is where the big difference is the past, yeah, does get dug up or unpacked. But what we're doing with it is not just revisiting or reliving bad experiences from the past. We're taking it and we're trying to learn from it. And one of the learnings is to heal and to grow forward. That's the big difference. I think that if you don't tell your story, then you're going to have a hard time moving through growth and forgiveness. And the big thing about why telling your story is so helpful is because it pulls your own self out of living in a type of obscurity, which is a self-created prison of its own. And we are moving to trying to encourage, you know, the upcoming generations that you don't have to keep living in fear that if something unfortunate has happened to you, or even if I am the one who has made bad choices, that that is not who I need to remain. That is, I think, one of the biggest things about telling a story is it facilitates this evolution or progression forward to move through things rather than seal them up and bury them and hold them inside you and try to live the rest of your life with just, you know, trying to get by with where I am at or who I have become because of some injury or mistake. So that's what I say as a response to her question is, I have no argument that it would cause her anxiety, fear, you know, a lot of sadness perhaps to think about or talk about things of the past. But if we will do that, it is a way to make the connections. And we need the connections with other people, particularly we've got to start with a better connection with ourselves. Because I would imagine that even if she's not fully aware, she is likely telling her story, her bad stories about herself over and over and over again, with only, and at times tries not to even go there because somebody else's story will remind her that she has her own story. I realize that that can happen, but I think if we're trying to create a better world, if we're trying to grow and evolve from learning, from experience, we have to allow ourselves to be forgiving.
You know, one thing that's interesting about not getting things out from your past in reference to your listener and what Mark has said, it makes me think about disease. And I've done some reading on basically what happens with our bodies when we hold things or harbor things within ourselves, that it's almost as though those feelings that aren't expressed lodge themselves in different parts of our body and cause unrest physically. And that a lot of people who've gone through traumatic experiences or different things, they harbor it because society kind of tells us, don't, boys don't cry, toughen up, suck it up, don't cry over spilt milk, whatever. And so a lot of times, a lot of families, a lot of these little quips have forced us to just hold everything in, hold everything in, hold everything in. And I think that that's a huge problem, because as we hold things in, I think that those actually lodge themselves in different body organs and different, eventually express themselves in disease. If I don't forgive somebody, I'm poisoning myself. And we don't see it in that way. But there's times where maybe we offended somebody. We don't even know we offended them. And we're going on our life. And we run into that person a couple of years later. And they bring up this point, and you're like, my gosh, I've lived the last couple of years of my life. I didn't know you're offended. I am so sorry. And ultimately, if we don't forgive somebody of something, it comes back on us. If somebody cuts us off in traffic, or, you know, is verbally unkind to us in a friendship or something, we have the ability to either let that roll off our back and deal with it and then move beyond it, or to just hold it in our, within ourselves. And by harboring it, I think that it causes more long-term damage. Does that make any sense at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
I'm reading a book right now by Bessel van der Kolk, I think is his name. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. And he's a psychiatrist who was working with VA patients and realizing that so many people who presented with things like schizophrenia was really just PTSD from all this trauma bottled up inside.
Oh, yeah. You know, it reminds me, too, of this conversation I was having with a Native American friend of mine and colleague. And, you know, he talks about in their culture, there's this reference about being spirit sick and the kind of things to do to release yourself from that. And in no way, Jimmy, are you trying to, you know, not recognize the pain and suffering that people who had been hurt and offended by the actions that you had done. And your message is not about that. And I can hear in your voice that you really wish you could heartfelt communicate and contact them and let them know, but that is not possible, and we'll just have to deal with it that way. But there's not an intention here to minimize what has happened. That is not the message. The message is that we must all do things to face whatever has happened. What has happened has happened. And it doesn't mean that anyone's trying to make an excuse for that. That is not the goal. But the message is that we can move forward here, and offender and offended can do things. And by telling a story is really a very human nature way of getting these things out. And by getting them out and doing it in a very dignified way, we can actually heal and move forward. And so, Nikki, I think that's also the message we would want listeners to have that may be hesitant or even bothered by hearing other people's stories. And we understand that it would stir up that their bad memories of their own past. But we're not leaving it just there as open and exposed and tattling on people. That is not the goal. It's actually to take these and work through them. And by so doing, we can then resolve them and not continue to carry them and have them be something that perhaps weighs oneself down, unresolved. And that is the weighed down, unresolved, frightened and hurt self that I will then use as my connection to people I care about. And I don't want to do that. And we would encourage our listeners to consider that if that's what's happening to you, you know, give it a chance, give it a try. Most people are going to be very forgiving and accepting and understanding once they understand your story. There's a psychological aspect here of never underestimate the power of repetitive thinking, that if I dwell on something, that aspect is going to magnify. If I dwell on the negative will magnify, and I will get better and better and more skilled at focusing and finding the negative. Mm-hmm. If I dwell on the positive magnifies. See, our human minds are pretty neutral about that. They are a respecter of no one. They are prejudiced to nothing. Whatever I dwell on, that's going to magnify. Get back up. There is no joy in staying down. And that is, I think, the message that I see from you riding your bike as the symbol is get back up. There is no joy in staying down.
What's interesting when you're in federal prison and when you're in the system is they really like to keep you under their thumb and remind you of who you are through their scope. You can only walk if your right shoulder is touching the wall, your hands have to be behind you, your head has to be down. You know, it's just a way of suppressing. Wasn't there some kind of a psychology experiment where they had students and they made some of them prisoners and some of them like the people in charge?
Oh yeah, Jimmy, you're referring to the Stanford Prison Experiment conducted at Stanford University by a psychologist named Philip Zimbardo. And they did it in the basement of one of the buildings there. Fascinating things that they actually had found. In fact, I remember listening to Dr. Zimbardo talk about this experiment once. And he said that it just started to develop and take a life of its own. And both, you know, the subjects and the experimenters got so into this that they actually had to shut it down. People start to go very much automatically into the roles and the labels and titles that they were given. So the participants who were given the position of being the guards really started to act and become like guards, like you're talking about. And then the participants who were the inmates, those students began to take on the persona of being an inmate, and it became so real and it started to become part of who they were. Really showed what and how easy we can become so locked into a role and an identity. But it, you know, the other thing though that you can glean from that is if we treat ourselves and other people differently, we can become that. If we start acting in a more forgiving nature and a more accepting nature to ourselves and to others, we will actually become forgiving and we will actually become, you know, more secure, more free, and live less by fear.
Well, because kindness wins every time.
Yes.
Kindness always wins. And if you're willing to be kind and be grateful and to just help people to be them their best selves, it's just better. You're just happier. Oh, it's yes. just as easy to look for the good in the day and the good in the experience as it is the bad.
If any of the listeners out there were you know, hurt by other people, or in this case, Jimmy, offended or hurt by things that you have done. Some of our listeners, many of our listeners may have and will have been hurt at the hands of somebody else. But the message to them is about this forgiveness and kindness, learning to let go, because, you know, like you were saying, you know, you have served your time, and in the eyes of the law, you have paid the price for the crimes you committed, the mistakes that have been made. What happens is the memory of it for self, the shaming and the guilting, and the memory of it, the pain and the suffering for somebody who had been offended or victimized, if that memory keeps being played or refreshed, then that pain or suffering never gets paid or healed. And, you know, again, you know, there is no intention here to minimize what has happened. But if any of our listeners are in this boat out there, in this position where, you know, after somebody who has offended you has done their best to make recompense, if you keep hanging on to this, you know, such as creating the, you know, watch out for Jimmy, he's a bad guy website, if that is those kinds of things, if we're doing those kinds of things, we are actually going to spirit sick ourselves or make or poison our own happiness, thinking that you are empowering yourself by continuing to be angry, hurt, and focus on beating down somebody who has made mistakes. This could be, in this case, Jimmy, your example, this could be, you know, a friend, this could be a parent, this could be somebody who has hurt or offended you. So everybody out there, you know, beware and be careful that by not being forgiving, by not being kind, we can become the very kind of person that we are fighting or you are fighting to not be.
I think this is really good. I know I've been really inspired by your story, and just your optimism to me is so courageous. How would our listeners find the real Jimmy Donahue?
So my Instagram handle is at Jimmy Donahue, JimmyDonahoo. That's probably the platform I use the most will be my Instagram. I am on Facebook as well and Twitter. Also, I'm putting out my own website, which I'm going to be publishing this week, which is going to be JimmyDonahue.net. So if you want to follow along on my journey, feel free to jump on my website, and I'll have different YouTube videos and my other aspects of my story that'll be on there.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. A pleasure. A pleasure. And thank you for sharing and being willing to share your story.
Yeah, you bet. Is there one more thing that I could just leave your audience with?
Please.
I guess I would say that regardless of what's going on in your life, as heavy as things may seem right now, you need to realize that the ability to overcome it is ultimately found from within you. And typically it's from within your heart. And for me, it's not something that I could do alone. For me, it was something that I had to do through prayer so that I could feel the strength within me to get back up. And the hard part about life is that in the heavy moments, we just get smashed down. And when we start to get back up, sometimes we're down again. And the important aspect is when we feel those alone moments, it's to take the time to pray. And when you take the time to pray, whatever your religious affiliation or background is or isn't, when you take the time to sincerely pray and listen and to breathe, you have the ability to get up. There is no staying down. There's no joy in being pressed. the joy is in what you become through the process. And you have to look at what's going on, and it's hard when you're in the middle of it. When you're in the middle of it, it's just, you're just getting beat. But when you look through afterwards at your ability to rise, I think that is ultimately what we're all after, is the ability to move beyond. And I think that one of the important aspects of moving beyond is realizing that and admitting we can't do it alone. And I don't think that we were intended to do it alone. You can be a good person and still make mistakes. You can be a good person and realize, man, that wasn't my best choice, and still be a good person. That's why they're called mistakes or accidents, right? They weren't on purposes. And I think that a lot of times we need to give ourselves a break, and when we feel ultimately alone, to just reach out.
I agree. Thank you so much.
And that's it for another Backseat Driver. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it with a friend.
We'd really appreciate it if you'd take a minute to rate and review our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.